Senator Al Franken issued a Thanksgiving Day apology to the women who've accused him of unwanted sexual advances. The Democrat from Minnesota said yesterday he felt terribly that he's made some women feel badly. He also apologized to his constituents. The list of powerful men accused of sexually harassing and sexually assaulting women has grown considerably in the past few weeks, but the fact is that sexual assault and other forms of misconduct have a long history in the United States, especially in the workforce. For a look back at this, we're joined now by Ed Ayers and Nathan Connolly. They're historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. And Nathan, start with you. One of the better-known examples from early American history of powerful men taking advantage of women is Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. She was the slave who gave birth to six of his children. But is it right to say that at that time, very few women, slave or free, had recourse against sexually abusive men?
Well, the laws around protection for women were basically, you know, an echo of what the laws were protecting slaves, which were basically, you know, only insofar as a person was considered property. And so much of the law protecting women in the workplace had to do with whether or not they were being, you know, deflowered or spoiled as potential, you know, bartering instruments in families that were trying to marry off daughters or, you know, to bear children. So the law really for women in much of the 19th century was about the usefulness, the kind of, you know, value of women to their fathers primarily. And so there's a whole area of law where women are forced to basically make claims about being damaged as people who belong to these families. And so it's very much an echo of how slaves had to try to make their claims if they were damaged by being rented out by their master to an employer, which, again, is not anything that really does reflect the fullness of, you know, a woman's personhood.
And right, of course. And in that case, it would probably be the father who would win any damages in any legal proceedings.
Yeah, there's an 1858 case, Dane versus Wyckoff in New York. The father sues his daughter's employer, she's 14, for getting her pregnant and thus losing her income when she has to quit and have the baby. The irony, of course, is that as women's opportunities continue to expand across the 19th century for work outside the home, work in which some of the rewards at least might be their own, these problems of sexual abuse and assault and harassment grew apace. And so even as the industrialization grows, so do the problems presented by men being in power over women. So it really takes off and never subsides. You know, every opportunity seems to be accompanied by another problem.
When did the term sexual harassment come to be?
Well, sexual harassment really is a term that was used in the 1970s to try to raise consciousness. An attorney by the name of Lynn Fairley tried to basically get the idea that harassment, you know, was a kind of discrimination. So you have to imagine, Peter, that the legal landscape is one in which people are making a variety of claims. And at the time, coming out of the 1960s, the principal way in which people talked about discrimination was very much rooted in the history of the civil rights movement. Mm. And there's a reason for that. That's actually linked very much to the history of women and the workplace, right? Because much of the story coming out of, as Ed pointed to, the factories and the work done in the progressive era, and especially through the work that was being done in the homes, oftentimes by black domestics through the Jim Crow period, was about sexual harassment. And so you find people like, for instance, Rosa Parks, who first really cut their teeth politically on trying to pursue claims against women for rape and sexual harassment in places like the Jim Crow South. Parks from Alabama, right? And so, you know, when you have a movement that then swells and gets legislation passed, as happened in the mid-1960s with the Civil Rights Act, you then find that serving as the foundation for subsequent claims by second-wave feminists like Lynn Fairley and Catherine McKinnon and others, another important legal mind, who are trying to find ways to create a broader definition of the way in which women's gender power and, again, their labor power is going to be protected in the workplace.
Well, and it's fascinating just how modern all of this is, because the first class action sexual harassment case wasn't until 1984, which is, you know, that's very much modern history.
It is. But it also, you know, bears keeping in mind that even prior to that, a lot of what would become these discrimination suits were open secrets in industries around the country. Right. You think about, for instance, you know, areas like, you know, the secretaries who were being harassed by their bosses, or obviously women who are trying to break into industrial work still in the post-war period. And even Hollywood, you know, during the golden age of big pictures, the problems of gender harassment and sexual harassment in the workplace are an industry open secret.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that Judy Garland, when she's filming Wizard of Oz and Ruby Red Slippers, is having to fight off Louis B. Mayer in those very same days, and Shirley Temple. And so, you know, what all this shows is that what we're seeing now is the tip of the iceberg being exposed. And it's shocking, really, how long it took for that to be exposed to public gaze when, as Nathan says, it had been an open secret in so many industries for so long.
Well, I do want to get to what we're experiencing today, but let's just take a look at 1991 first. That was when Anita Hill testified against Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas. It was huge news, watching the confirmation hearing on TV. Take us back to that time. What happened, and how are we still feeling the impacts of that today?
Well, in the wake of the resignation of Thurgood Marshall, obviously a really prominent figure in the history of American law, the president, George Herbert Walker Bush, thought to appoint another African-American, in this case Clarence Thomas, who had worked with Reagan as part of the EEOC, that's the Equal Opportunities Employment Commission, as well as in the Department of Education. And Thomas seemed pretty much like a lock. However, there was a document that was leaked to the FBI that included this mention of Thomas basically engaging in lewd behavior in the workplace, and that document mentioned Anita Hill. Congress calls Hill forward. She testifies under oath. And all of a sudden, we're having a conversation about sexual harassment, again, from the guy accused, with the accused being the former head of the EEOC, right, and an African-American man. So no small accusation whatsoever. And this particular moment in American history absolutely begins to put front and center, you know, one, what's the experience of women of color working under men of color in these, you know, environments? But also, is it even possible to take down a powerful man who's accused of some pretty, you know, horrific things?
And we should probably acknowledge Anita Hill at that point. It's 1991. She's coming forward with these allegations. She must have been going through the ringer doing that.
Well, she was, and polls showed that Americans didn't believe her by a ratio of 2-1. And so the courage to step forward and not finding, like today, that people are sort of stepping up and say, I believe the woman, but instead saying, you know, I don't believe the woman.
Right.
Well, we have, of course, President Clinton and Paula Jones in the 1990s. There's sexual assault cases in the military that we're well aware of now. The stories that we've seen with Harvey Weinstein in Hollywood, Kevin Spacey. Do you have any confidence at all, gentlemen, that history has taught us anything about this?
Well, I think one thing is clear, which is that when you have these groundswells of, you know, civic engagement and political consciousness, the legal system will, in fact, respond. I mean, again, just thinking about the case of Anita Hill, I mean, it was one thing to see Clarence Thomas still be confirmed, even in spite of Hill's testimony. But no one can argue that that moment helped to raise new consciousness about what sexual harassment meant in the workplace. There were entire groups of women who were mobilized in the wake of that episode. One group, for instance, the African-American Women in Defense of Ourselves, you know, got over 1,600 signatures just in the wake of that particular episode. And now we're seeing, you know, a new level of awareness about abuses in Hollywood, the very kinds of which, you know, Ed was describing in the 1950s. And the question really does remain, will we see a new round of organizing or, you know, women who are celebrities being able to, you know, speak and be believed in public about the accusations they're making toward their powerful male counterparts?
Ed, do you agree?
I do. And what's striking is how quickly people mobilized after Anita Hill, not just in the spirit of anger or honesty, but in lawsuits and mobilization, right? And so I think Nathan's right. What's amazing is how rapidly the ground can shift beneath people's feet. And think about how our language changes before it's womanizing or it's, you know, being fresh. Now it's being called by what it is. Those are big changes. When our language changes, often our ideas change to go along with it.
That's Ed Ayers and Nathan Connolly. They're historians and co-hosts of the podcast Backstory. Thanks very much.
Thank you.